Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. In the last class, we talked about the British empiricists. And I'm afraid when I discussed the British empiricists with you, I did not emphasize enough that they are only part of a larger story. I noticed a few people left about halfway through. Either my English was too fast, my German was too bad, or the British empiricists were not interesting enough. And so if you remember, I promised you that today we would talk about Schopenhauer and Freud with lots of sex. So I'm glad to see that you came back. But I do want to recall one little thing that came up at the end of the last set of slides, and that was the picture of Immanuel Kant. And the slide, I won't put it on the screen, but the slide had said something about a sleeping giant was awakened. Because after the British empiricists made their various points, the most difficult of which were the denial of our ability to know causes and to know substances, including the substance of the self, Immanuel Kant thought, oh my God, this is very important. And he developed a new approach, which was then picked up by Schopenhauer, whom we will talk about for the first part of this afternoon's class, and then by Freud, whom we will talk about for the rest of the class. So, with that in mind, let's carry on, and we see once again the general formulas, the big question, the four columns, etc. And here we have once again a little review: quest, knowing the good, human flourishing, quest for certainty, then the classical empiricist, human development consisted in the acquisition of experience, by which was meant developing all kinds of ideas and sensations. Today we are going to talk about Schopenhauer and Freud, and insofar as we can put them together, and it's not always a perfect fit, but it's good enough. Their concept of human development was that we empower the ego. That's what it means to develop yourself as a human person, to give yourself greater and greater ego strength. The models of the mind, no longer do we have the empiricist theory of the mind as a blank slate, but rather we have multiple levels of consciousness, and we'll see exactly how that works. Multiple levels because Freud had his famous three levels of consciousness: the unconscious, the conscious, and the Über-Ich, the superego consciousness. But Schopenhauer had a slightly different arrangement. We'll see all of that in a minute. The method of inquiry that they used, and here I'm talking mainly about, well, entirely about Freud, was clinical interviews and interpretations. In other words, Freud did not use the kind of approach that the empiricist did, which would have been Occam's razor, but rather he would let somebody talk to him, and then he would try to figure out what the person's hidden messages were, and this idea of interpretation was critical and, of course, criticized by many later psychological theorists. But anyway, that's what he did. Take it or leave it, but that's Sigmund Freud. And finally, their conceptions of self and society were quite different. In this case, Schopenhauer had a much different conception of society than Freud. Freud's most famous conception was embodied in the book Civilization and Its Discontents. That's the English title. I believe the German title is Kultur in seiner Behagen. Is it Kultur or Zivilisation?
Unbehagen in der Kultur.
Unbehagen in der Kultur. Okay. Now, both of them, however, achieved a breakthrough with what we might want to call the discovery of the unconscious. Arthur Schopenhauer and then Sigmund Freud. Let me just pick up my notes over here. Very briefly, Arthur Schopenhauer was born, as you see, in 1788. He was born in Danzig. He studied throughout Europe. He was Privatdozent in Berlin. And then he lived as a Privatgelehrter in Frankfurt. In fact, he lived on Schöne Aussicht, which was only two houses away from the place where my wife worked in Frankfurt many years ago. So it has a kind of a symbolic meaning to me. Sigmund Freud was born in 1856, died in 1939, just as World War II was starting. He was born in Moravia, now in the Czech Republic. He spent most of his life in Vienna and then died in London. The historical context of these two gentlemen is rich and almost impossible to talk about even in a full-length book, certainly not in a simple slide. But the basic ideas are as follows. Schopenhauer lived during the era of German idealism that was associated with Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel, all of whom Schopenhauer dismissed as charlatans. Is that, that's a French word, is it a Deutsch word too? Charlatan? Yeah. So Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, it's all nonsense. He had much more respect for their great predecessor, Immanuel Kant. And Schopenhauer tried to reconstruct Kant's own distinction between phenomenal and noumenal reality, I'll say more about that in a minute, Schopenhauer tried to reconstruct that great distinction in his own famous work, Die Welt als Wille und Vorstellung. In that work, Schopenhauer developed his theory that the world, which is to say reality, exists simultaneously as will, die Wille, and also as representation, Vorstellung. By the way, the German title, Wille und Vorstellung, is often translated in English as the world as will and idea. So if you are mooching around on the web and you see will and idea, that's the same book that is also referred to as will and representation. Aren't you glad you only have one word to worry about in your language? All right. Schopenhauer was probably best known for his pessimism. Also, I'm embarrassed to say, for his negative views on women. But he did say, and he had a theory of genetics, that we get our Wille, our strength, our courage, our power from our fathers, but we get our intelligence from our mothers. Well, enough said. Schopenhauer's own life was relatively comfortable, even though he thought of life itself as futile and wicked. Actually, he had a large inheritance from his father. That helped a little. Nonetheless, his philosophical conception of Die Wille led him to believe that life was full of suffering and conflict. And he has the famous image in his book, Die Welt als Wille und Vorstellung. He has this famous image of the Australian bull ant. What's the word for ant? Say it again. Yeah, right. Thank you. And this ant, when it is severed, the head from the tail, somehow it keeps on, both parts keep on living, and they attack each other. They fight to the death. His own formula of living, like that of Hinduism and Buddhism, which he was familiar with, although he only became familiar with it later in his life. He said, "My God, this is wonderful. They're saying the same thing as I am." He didn't feel threatened, but rather exalted and confirmed by what he read in the Buddhist and Hindu literature. But anyway, his own formula for life was to escape from suffering through aesthetic contemplation. I said aesthetic with a TH, meaning the appreciation for beauty. But also for ascetic living, where I'm saying now ascetic without the H, as in ascetismus? What? Right. So he had this combination of aesthetics and ascetics, as it were. Anyway, his influence on 19th century culture was enormous. Much more enormous than you might pick up today if you were reading an ordinary history or history of philosophy book. And I intended to bring here a poster, which I left upstairs, for a lecture that was given last night. And I'll ask Georg to help me. The name of the professor, the author, was the Romantic. That was the name of the book. It was heavily advertised. And did any of you see that, hear him last night? You did? How was it? Was it? Can you tell us just a word or two about it? I mean, he spoke of De Romanticus. He talking about Romeo and Juliet?
No.
Oh.
Auf Deutsch
bitte. In welcher Jahrhundert?
No, what happened now? Last century.
Oh, he's talking about our own. Well, the book is about the 19th Jahrhundert.
Yeah, but no, it goes like from 19th century to 18th century to now.
I see. So he went through the whole thing, yeah. And I was so interested in the fact that he talks at great length with great, shall I say, I got the impression that he really feels that his readers are fully aware of the phenomenon of the romantic. And that's probably true. Georg tells me it's true. Georg thinks that all of you are familiar with this. To me, it's a very foreign concept. Well, you say, well, souls, there's the Americana. But this idea of there being a Weltgeist, a Zeitgeist, a Folkgeist, all these geists, a Poltergeist, they're all out there. And to me, this is a little bit of a stretch. It's almost like a piece of exotic anthropology. But my sense is that for you it is not a stretch, that you are very comfortable with this idea that there are these geistliche forces running through history, and that it's not necessary for me to this afternoon to explain the geistliche quality of Schopenhauer and even Freud's own thought. But let me, even though I'm not explaining it, remind you that Schopenhauer, like even the charlatans that he criticized, was very, very convinced that there is this mysterious realm of reality, the most basic part of reality that is virtually impossible to express. It can be expressed, but only indirectly, through, let us say, literature, music, etc., etc., etc. Okay, well, with all of that in mind, unless there are questions, well, let's go to the next. Was that a question? No. He's just scratching. Okay. How does this work here? There. Oh, I forgot to talk about Freud. Silly me. Sorry. Freud. Well, Freud, as you know, came of age during the Austro-Hungarian Empire, where anti-Semitic policies affected his life in many ways, even though his own father was a free thinker and he himself was an atheist. Freud took a medical degree in Vienna in neurology. But he went on to Paris to learn more about this new practice of hypnosis. But then he returned to Vienna in 1886 and discovered, somewhat to his surprise, that he did not need to hypnotize his patients in order to get them to articulate their problems. Because that's what he wanted to do, following the lead of people like Anton Messner and so on. He wanted to get people to tell him their problems. But all he had to do was put them on a couch. He did not have to hypnotize them. But he had to not just put them on a couch. He had to put them on the couch in the right way. Skillful interview techniques involving free association and the interpretation of dreams were enough to open the door to what he began to call the unconscious mind. And now do you hear the Schopenhauerian music in the background? Dum, da, dum, dum. No, that's somebody else. But anyway, there is in the earliest stages of Freud's theory this attention to the unconscious mind. Pretty good for a neurologist, no? No? So you're supposed to say yes. But anyway, here we have a neurologist who is investigating the unconscious mind. Today, that would be unthinkable. Well, maybe that's not the right word to use. In 1900, which was just a decade or so later, he introduced his notion to the public in his book, The Interpretation of Dreams. And this may not be the most famous book, but historically, it's probably the most groundbreaking and historically significant book that Freud ever wrote. It is a matter of debate whether this and other Freudian theories, whether the theory of the unconscious as well as other theories from Freud, were directly or indirectly influenced by Schopenhauer. But certainly the resemblance is profound. Now, why am I saying this last sentence? I'm making this last sentence because Freud himself claimed that Schopenhauer did not influence him. He said, "I only read Schopenhauer late in my life." But a lot of critics smell a rat here, because Freud used some of the same imagery, some of the same language as Schopenhauer. It really looks like he ripped Schopenhauer off, but maybe not. Maybe that's unfair. Or perhaps a more gentle interpretation was that the Schopenhauerian model was running around on its own, as it were, and Freud picked it up either directly by having heard somebody who had just read Schopenhauer talk, or indirectly through unconscious influence. But at any rate, the similarity is often noticed, and you don't get a Nobel Prize for pointing out that Freud said the same thing in many respects as Schopenhauer. We know that. Freud became a professor at the University of Vienna in 1902. And this is a very important point, not only because he got a better salary, but also because this gave him a professional visibility so that he was now able to function as a legitimate authority, both in Vienna and also elsewhere, where little groups of disciples were beginning to form. And it was good that he had this authority. He was a neurological professor at the University of Vienna, because his theories were beginning to have kind of a shock value. But instead of being dismissed as another charlatan, he was able, thanks to his professorate, he was able to present his ideas to a relatively open-minded audience. Ironically, many of his pessimistic views about human nature were confirmed during the rise of Nazism during those very same years. So now the big question. What drives us on? That's what they wanted to know. Have any of you ever read anything or heard or even heard about a contemporary, recently deceased philosopher named Ernst Bloch? Not a big name? Well, Bloch was a... he was not exactly a member of the Frankfurt School, but he was a philosopher, very... he spent most of his time in the DDR, but he finished his life in Tübingen. And he posed the same question. Was treibt uns an? That's actually a quotation from Ernst Bloch, whom I studied some time ago, many years ago, in fact. Unfortunately, Bloch's answer was this. He said, was treibt uns an? And he said, his answer was, der Trieb. I said, what? So then I stopped reading German philosophy for, you know, the next 30 years. I'm back. But the Freudian version of the question is perhaps a little more intellectually solid. The question of human motivation, this question, I mean, is related to two other, even more important questions. What is the nature of reality, and what sort of knowledge can we have of reality? And we'll take those up now. I'm going to start with, spend a little more time on Schopenhauer than you might expect, not only because I kind of like Schopenhauer, but also because I do want you to understand that Freud and the post-Freudian psychological movement has its philosophical roots. Now, is Freud himself a philosopher? Well, as I think I mentioned last week, that's an open question. If you go over to this professor of empirical or cognitive psychology, he will say Freud was no psychologist. Freud was either a philosopher or a charlatan or both. If you go to a philosopher, your typical philosopher in the contemporary tradition, they'll say Freud? He was no philosopher. He was a psychologist. So poor Freud, nobody wants him. The abandoned baby. And so I, in order to keep the professors of psychology at the University of Konstanz from coming after me, have decided to simply say, well, Freud is a transition figure. Schopenhauer is clearly a philosopher. This gives you the philosophical roots of contemporary, one of the roots of contemporary psychology. And Freud picked up what he had to say. Was Freud himself a philosopher, part of the philosophical roots? Was he a philosophical root himself? Or is he the flower, what's the word for flower, blume? The blume, from the root. I don't know. Go ask your psychology professors. Ask Georg, he'll tell you all about it. So first of all now, let's talk about their conceptions of human development. And in both cases, that is the case of Schopenhauer and the case of Freud, they saw two strategies. I use the phrase coping strategy. Does that phrase work? For Stancy? It does. How would you translate it auf Deutsch? Yeah, I know. I'm not sure how to... Georg?
Bewildigungsstrategie.
Ah. It's like being tamed, huh? Yeah. Okay, well, in other words, enables you to accommodate yourself to the demands of your environment. And so, we renounce desire, we call that asceticism, and we regulate desire, and we call that rationality. Now, the first of these two was preferred by Schopenhauer, and he was relatively pessimistic. His dominant strategy was that we try to renounce our desire, but he says that's what we try to do, but it's really kind of hopeless. But anyway, that was his... It's not that he was against rationality, but this was his primary This was Schopenhauer's primary strategy. For Freud, the primary strategy was rationality. This was his dominant strategy. And Freud was relatively optimistic. Freud thought that although rationality had its limits, we could go pretty far with it. And we could cope, we could adjust, we could... Bewildern? What's bewildern? Huh? Okay.
Bewältigen.
Bewältigen. Ah, okay. Misunderstood. Thanks. Well, we got that straight. I'm really sorry for my German, but it's George Bush is saying that, you know, we're on the verge of World War III, and I have a feeling that by coming over here and talking about things auf Deutsch, I'm contributing to this. But with a little luck, his prophecy will be as mistaken as some of his other statements. But anyway, I've already apologized too many times for my bad German. It's clear that not going to get any better over the next 2 weeks. So, fahr und verlos. Asceticism as the renunciation of desire. Now, Schopenhauer tried to reduce the power of desire by refraining from willing. Schopenhauer and Freud both believed that our desires could not be completely extinguished, put out. But only Schopenhauer tried to reduce their power by this program of what he called refraining from willing. And I'll come back to this, but I would like right at the beginning to point out a little something very interesting. What about suicide? If Schopenhauer really thought that we should stop desiring things, because, you know, the more you desire, the more you want, the more you want, the less you get, relatively anyway, and you're more dissatisfied. This is an old theme that comes out of the Greek and Roman Stoics. It's also been said by other people, reduce your desires and then you will be happy, because happiness consists in the ratio of the desires to the fulfillment of the desires. If you have very few desires and they're fulfilled, then the total ratio is very, very positive. If you have a lot of desires that can't be fulfilled, then you're unhappy.
It's good to remember in Christmas time.
He has two children. You can tell. But anyway, that is the standard strategy in asceticism, including stoical theory. Anorexis was the Greek word here, simply meant reduce your desires and you can increase your overall happiness. So why not reduce them all the way and kill yourself? Then you won't be unhappy at all. Well, of course, that's not a strategy that a lot of people would endorse. But still, is there anything logically wrong with this idea of radical asceticism, the idea of completely extinguishing your desires by extinguishing yourself? Schopenhauer said, yes, there's something wrong with that. Because when you commit suicide, you have a desire to commit suicide. And you're acting on that desire. And so you're falling into the old trap. You just come up with something you want to do, and now you're all worked up over wanting to do it. Because, as he said, and this is a quotation translated into English, suicide actually wills, or if you wish, desires life, and it is dissatisfied on the conditions with which life has come to us. So suicide is an expression of dissatisfaction, and the point of asceticism is to minimize your dissatisfaction. And so asceticism, which is not the same as suicide, is the preferred strategy. Get rid of your pleasures, reduce your desires, you avoid sufferings, that is the sufferings of frustration, and you may not be wildly happy, but you're not wildly unhappy either. Now there are two paradoxes here. The one I've just mentioned, that the desire to renounce desire, which would be taken literally in suicide, is itself a form of willing. And asceticism is a form of rationality. And so what do we do with these? Well, the resolution, devilla, is more than human desire or rationality. And that leads me now to a whole new level of explanation. Up until now, I've been giving you kind of the comic book version of Schopenhauer. And I don't know if it made much sense or not. But in fact, when he speaks of die Wille, he is not talking about your will or my will. He's talking about a cosmic will. Many people have thought that Schopenhauer was a pantheist. You know, that there is this one cosmic thing called God, or cosmos, or reality, or villa, and that it's a kind of a living, powerful, throbbing thing of some, it's kind of, you know, some sort of a supergeist. But at any rate, you must understand that when you speak of die Wille, and in English it's translated with a capital W, I know in German it's always got a W, but we specialize in English with capital letters indicating big stuff. And will with a capital W refers to this cosmic force which is called it's called by desire, it's called force, Bergson called it elan vital. There are a lot of different ways of trying to verbalize what this cosmic force is. Schopenhauer chose the word Wille. But even then he realized that his vocabulary was limited. It's like trying to call God a name. Trying to call God by some name like God. I mean, do you think God, if there is a God, would recognize himself in all of these descriptions that we have in the various theistic religions? Well, my personal view is no. My personal view is that God is an atheist. My personal view is that he looks down and smiles very broadly on all these attempts to put himself into a box. But that's my personal view, and it's not why you're here tonight to hear my personal view. Let's talk about Schopenhauer's personal view. But with this idea of God, not God, of die Wille as a cosmic force, we go back now to the British empiricists of all people. And if you remember, Locke talked about substance as that mysterious X that was that the turtle was standing on. Remember, we had the man on top of the elephant on top of the turtle, and the turtle on top of, well, did I know not what. But that I know not what, that mysterious X, that was what underlies all things. And then he came along a little bit later, and they said, well, how about the self? And he didn't have much to say about the nature of the self either. But Hume did. Hume had something very, very powerful to say about the self, namely, that there wasn't one. Or if there is one, we have no way of experiencing it. Whenever I look in my own heart, he says, I only find a bundle of perceptions. And so it was this idea, namely, that the ultimate reality out there and the ultimate reality in here are basically unknowable, that caused Immanuel Kant to awake from his dogmatic slumber. That's the phrase he used. I was in my dogmatic slumber. He was asleep, intellectually asleep. Then he read Hume and Locke, especially Hume, and he said, Gottes Willen, was ist? And so he then tried to develop a theory that did justice to the problems that these British empiricists had presented. And he came up with the idea that there are two orders of reality. The phenomenal order that appears to us, and the noumenal order. That's spelled N-O-U-M-E-N-A-L, or the Greek N-O-U-M-E-N-O-N. It was what he refers to as the Ding an sich. There's the Ding für uns, that's the appearances. Those dings are right here in our little heads. But the Ding an sich, we can't know anything about that. All we can do, said Kant, is to figure out the conditions under which it is possible for us to have any experience whatsoever. And he went on to develop a whole lot of theories about science, about morality, about art, about religion, about politics. But he always kept this kept reminding you that he was only talking about the way things appeared to you. Because the Ding an sich, that's an sich. That's out there. And it's always out there. It's always away. It's always on the far side. And the closer you get to it, the further away it goes, which is a paradox. And it was this idea of a radically unknowable Ding an sich that inspired Schopenhauer. Except he called the Ding an sich will, die Wille. But just like Kant said that the Ding an sich makes its appearance to you and you know its appearances, one of our primary ways of knowing the Ding an sich is to think about it as though it were spatial and temporal, as though it had space and time as its structures. Is the Ding an sich really a spatio-temporal reality? Probably not. It's just that that's the only way we can think about it. Just like I told you about Billy a couple of weeks ago, who said, yes, God did have a penis, but it was infinite. Well, that was the only way Billy could think about God, apparently, as not as a giant penis, but as a male figure. And so, why laugh at Billy? He was simply trying to wrap his mind around a very, very elusive, distant concept. And similarly, you and I, when we think that the world occupies a space-time continuum, that reality really does move through the old days to the modern moment to the future, and that there really is stuff over there and over there, that's the only way we can think about it. But that's not the way things really are. The Ding an sich, and notice it's singular, the Ding an sich is an sich. But we have these representations of it. And that's why the title of his book is Die Wille, or Die Welt als Wille und Vorstellung. That the world, which is to say reality, consists in the Wille, the Ding an sich, and the experiences we have of it, and that's the Vorstellungen. Isn't that interesting? And similar divisions occur in Freudian theory. Freud often talks about the id, as though basically there's nothing you can say about it in itself. But you experience it. Your life is structured by it. But the structures of your life correspond to your personal situation, not to the nature of the S in itself. The, if I may use the phrase, the S on sich. So anyway, I haven't said much about Freud yet, but trust me, I will. Rationality supposedly is the regulation of desire. A moment ago, I was talking about these two paradoxes, and now I want to go into this idea of rationality. And here again, I want to compare the two by showing, first of all, that Freud had a great emphasis on reality, on rationality. Now, Freud was not a super rationalist, but he thought rationality was pretty important. He thought it was a lot more important than Schopenhauer did. Freud recognized that we will never completely solve the problem of suffering and unfulfilled desire, a point that Schopenhauer had certainly made many times. But Freud, unlike Schopenhauer, placed a greater emphasis on the power of our human reason to, shall we say, make things a little better. And Freud was therefore relatively more optimistic about the prospect for human happiness than Schopenhauer was. However, Freud never forgot the horrors of World War I, and he was aware of the increasingly ominous prospects of World War II, and that's why he had moved to England. Also, Freud's analysis of the way rationality works with the will is much more detailed. Is much more detailed than Schopenhauer's is. Schopenhauer didn't. He had all these wonderful, extravagant statements, but he didn't get down to the nitty gritty as much as Freud did. Now, I know some psychologists would say that Freud did not get down to the nitty-gritty either, but we'll see about that in the next few slides. But before we go any further, I'd like to take just a minute out to do a little dictionary work. Freud's lexicon. You know that in English, we have translated Freud's three categories, Ich, Es, and Über-Ich, as the ego, the id, and the superego, which come from the Latin versions of those. I tried to clean this PowerPoint slide up so that I use the German often enough, but are you familiar with the English phrases? The superego? This is not a common phrase for you? Okay. But you are familiar with the phrase Über-Ich, because you had that at the gymnasium, yeah, or your therapist. Do you think it's time? Are we ready for a joke yet? Let's take a little break. Let's have a little joke. So the man went to the therapist, and he said, Doc, I'm having a lot of trouble with sexual thoughts. The doctor said, well, let's see if we can analyze this. So the doctor, who was not, he was a partly Freudian, but he also used other personality projection techniques. And so he drew a picture, just a very simple picture, a couple of lines. So what do you see there? The man said, sex. Doctor drew another picture, even more basic. What do you see there? Sex. The doctor drew another and another, over and over again, these very simple, sometimes complicated, but almost always simple pictures. The guy always said he saw sex, he saw sex, he saw sex. Finally, the doctor said, well, I guess you're right. You have a very serious obsession with sex. And the man said, well, what do you mean? You're the one who is drawing the filthy pictures. Much of this stuff on the blackboard, on the screen, needs explaining. What do you think, Eric? Think we could just move on, or?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, the basic idea is that the ego is your rational consciousness. The unconscious is, well, it's mostly not entirely unconscious. Then the superego is over here. Then we have these different processes. And this category of Besetzung and Anti-Besetzung, we call it, for some reason, cathexis and anti-cathexis. That is because one guy who lived in the early 20th century translated Freud that way, and his translation has just, you know, through a kind of historical accident, taken over. But this is not very important for what I have to say tonight. And indeed, he stopped using that language about halfway through his career. The others are more important. Okay. By the way, you know that this goes on the web. You can always look it up, along with the notes. I've got my little notes down here at the bottom. You don't see them now, but they'll be on the web. So let's now talk about Freud's idea of psychoanalysis and human development. Freud never thought that we could eliminate the unconscious. We could never completely get rid of our, shall we say, lower self. Nor could we even completely articulate or bring to consciousness our lower self, those libidinal rumblings, those desires that sometimes leak out. You know, you say something really bad and really embarrassing, and then you try to make a joke out of it. You say, oh, it must have been a Freudian slip. But we all know, you let your lower self out for a minute and ha ha ha. But anyway, although Freud himself thought we could never eliminate these things, he did think that with psychoanalysis, I mean the therapy, not the theory, with the psychoanalytical therapy, we can make good progress in that direction, namely the direction of bringing our desires into consciousness and then regulating them. And so he had this phrase, wo es war, ich sein solle. Where your unconscious libidinal forces were, with a little therapy, you can turn them into ego. You can turn them into rationality. You can, shall we say, tame them. Wo es war, ich sein soll. And he said that. But well, but the next quotation. Look at the full quote here. I'm sorry it's not auf Deutsch. But anyway, he said, psychotherapy, that is the method that he had invented, was supposed to strengthen your ego, strengthen your rational powers, to widen its field of perception so that you can really get a full range of desires and impulses under your rational control, and to enlarge its organization, in other words, put the ego really in charge so that you don't have these self-defeating desires, but now you are organizing your desires. And so, you know, you cannot have your cake and eat it too. You are aware of that. You have that expression auf Deutsch? We say to the young child, we say, Johnny, you cannot have your cake and eat it too.
Man kann sich nicht den Pilz waschen, ohne nass zu werden.
Yeah, that'll be the same thing, yeah. And that is what Freud called the reality principle. Because you see, the das S, your basic unconscious desires, they don't think things through. It's not a rational power. It's just a desire. And if I want a desire to clean myself, but I also desire to be dry, and then you have somebody come along and say, whatever it was you just said, this is, the unconscious cannot handle that. That's the kind of organizing procedure that takes place in consciousness. And I don't know if you have much contact with small children, but it can be very demanding because a kid will eat something and then cry because it's gone. Johnny, I said, you cannot have your cake and eat it too. And the kid says, why not? Why not? Well, the kid is not working at the ego level. The kid is working at the lower level, you see. And so the principle of desire and the principle of organizing desire, those are two very, very different capacities or powers. So anyway, that's what Freud is talking about here, that psychotherapy is to strengthen the ego and let it do all of these good things so that it can appropriate fresh portions of the id, the S. And now look at this quotation, because this is really why I put the thing up on the screen. Where ego is, where ich is, there... Oh, that's a mistake, isn't it? Yeah, where id, this is, I'm sorry for me, how many of you caught this was a test? They all caught me, didn't they? Okay, well, they did a good job, y'all. Where irrational desire, where the unconscious was, there shall ego be. It is a reclamation work of culture, not unlike the draining of the Zuidersee. And here we have the German, und der diesen Übergriff mit dem Trockenlegen der Zuidersee vergleicht. What is the Zuidersee? I'll give you a hint, it's in Holland. Is there a Niederlander in the house? Georg, could you go out there and see if you could find us a Dutchman, please? Well, it was sometime in the first part of the 20th century. I think it was around 1910. The Dutch decided that they were going to take this big body of water and put the dike up. I'm not sure what the German for dike is, some kind of a bond. Dike? Yeah. And move all the water out, and then they would have more land. And they could, you know, build houses and windmills and tulips. But it was a big project, and it was never ending because they were always having to build new walls. And the ocean was always trying to come back in. And this was the part of the North Sea that is located in the south. And the word here, Zuider, is south. The Zuiderzee, the South Sea, as opposed to this is the southern part of the North Sea. And so that's what he said. But there's one little mistake here, and I'm going to criticize Freud. What Freud said was where the id S was, there shall ego be. What he really ought to have said is, there should ego be, because it doesn't always work. This refers to the goal, not to the fact of psychoanalysis. All right. Now I'm going to move a little more quickly. How are we doing? Are you following me? How many have heard most of this before? You know, put your hands up. This will be very helpful to me. Okay. Three or four. Okay.
You mean on Freud?
On Freud, yeah. Oh, on the Freud. How many have heard all of this Freudian stuff before? Well, maybe not quite half the class. Well, that helps. We can talk about the psychosexual stages. This is always very interesting. But it will be on the web, and I've got pictures. Let's see. You know, the oral stage is the first 18 months. The anal stage, the next 18 months. Then the next 36 months, next 3 years, to the phallic stage. Then we have moratorium. Is that a German word? Yeah, moratorium. Kind of a waiting period. Latency, it's called. And then puberty hits, and then we have the genital stage, and away we go. Is if you have a trauma during one of these stages of your childhood, and you know what I mean by a trauma, something very bad happens, you lose a parent, you're injured, you have some horrifying experience, say during your oral stage, you have some horrifying experience, then as an adult you would exhibit odd patterns of behavior having to do with your mouth or face. And so on for the other stages. So, in other words, as it says here, in daily life, especially in times of stress, we tend to flee back to the time when we were most happy. And if you have had a trauma in those days, somehow that causes you to go back to your earlier, to regress. And so, for instance, at the oral stage. During the original oral stage, I read from the PowerPoint, pleasure comes mainly from putting objects in the mouth. adults who are traumatized during this period do odd things related to oral gratification. Including one example Freud gave was that they grow mustaches. I think he was probably talking about men. So these odd things refer to things like overeating, because that has to do with the mouth, playing with lips and teeth, growing a mustache, being obsessed with oral hygiene, or smoking. But sometimes, and another quotation from Freud, sometimes he said, because you know he didn't smoke, he said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Yeah. The anal stage. During the original anal stage, children derive pleasure from having bowel movements by playing with their feces, and later exercising control over their bowels. Adults who are traumatized during this period behave accordingly. What are Freud's examples there? Well, he says they use a lot of toilet language. They worry about bathroom issues, and they are obsessed with cleanliness and organization. They make good bankers or accountants. And that's the point of the picture here, the Bank of the Women's, you know, the bankers, and they're having his anal moment. The phallic stage. During the phallic stage, libidinal energies relocate to the genital region, and we know all about the Oedipal complex, and the Electra complex is less understood. I'm not sure whether it was Freud or one of his successors that tried to cook up a female version of the Oedipal complex that was so-called the Electra complex. But anyway, what happens is, I'm thinking of little boys here, but I guess little girls might have similar stories. They're, you know, 5 or 6 years old, and they're in there, and they're playing with themselves, and suddenly the door opens, and mother says, "What are you doing?" Trauma, moratorium, goes underground. Then 8 or 9 years later, he's back. Now he's got his phallus, and all kinds of crazy things happen in adolescence. But if you are fixated to this stage, then again you will have various problems. And when you hit your puberty and adulthood, your sexual behavior might be a little bit, shall we say, kinky. You'll have distorted conceptions of masculinity or femininity. You might flip back and forth between promiscuity and asexuality. In other words, one day you're very lecherous, the next day you're very, very asexual. Or you might go between being totally amoral or being totally puritanical. And you might have problems with close personal relationships. All kinds of good stuff that can happen if you are traumatized during the phallic stage. The genital stage. During the genital stage, sexuality, as it is usually understood, develops. Actually, I guess I kind of jumped the gun here. This is where mother comes into the bedroom and catches the kid and traumatizes him during the genital stage. But anyway, this whole idea of these traumas embody the conflict between nature and culture. The cartoon here is probably more appropriate to the anal stage. But the point at issue here is that as the kid is trying to come into consciousness, come into control of his or her own sexuality, there are these larger social forces embodied in the personality of the parent that are forcing the kid into cultural boxes. And so we have then the confrontation between nature and culture when the father, during what is Zauber training? Is that what it's called? Do I get the right word? Is that the right word? No? It's not the right word. We call it in English potty training. And socialization, according to this model, could be considered as potty training or toilet training writ large. Well, so much for these various concepts of human development. It's hard to be a grown-up. It's hard to get into maturity. And you're never completely mature. But for Freud, at least, it was possible through these various programs of controlling your desire. And he got the basic inspiration of this, I'm sure, he got from Schopenhauer. But now let's move to the next of the four columns of our standard diagram, namely the models of the mind. And here again, I'm treating the two thinkers somewhat in parallel. Schopenhauer's model had one reality, namely the will, die Wille, and multiple objectifications. And the German word for that Schopenhauer used for objectification was Objektivierung. In other words, the same, it's just a cognate. And these objectifications are thought of as either rationality, namely your power of thinking, or physical things themselves. We'll come back to that. Freud's model, he had two layers, the conscious and the unconscious, and three domains, the S, Ich, and Ich. So they had two somewhat different models of the mind. It's not that these two models contradict each other, but they were playing somewhat different games. Let's take Schopenhauer's game first, his metaphysical model of the world and mind as will. So as I've said now, when I reached back earlier in the class and referred to Kant, I said that reality, which is to say Wille, can be thought of in two ways. As it appears to us, that was what Kant called phenomenal, and as it is in itself, which Kant called noumenal, the Ding an sich. But although noumenal reality is not itself an appearance, that is to say, you've never seen it, you can still talk about it. And Schopenhauer did. What can you say about noumenal reality? Well, what Schopenhauer said was this, that we can recognize that this noumenal reality, this Ding an sich, is a blind force. It runs the world. And it runs individuals within the world, like you and me. And although there are many different ways of describing this blind force, a very good way is to take your experience of having a desire or a will and projecting that onto the Ding an sich. I mean, you all know what it is to want something. So let's just call this big, huge, mysterious reality, this I know not what, let's just call it Wille. Because Wille is a perfectly powerful word and so on. So we use the word Wille to talk about the big cosmic force, reality, with the understanding that this is a somewhat extended use of the term. That is to say, the Wille that is the cosmic force that runs the world is not really too much like your will and my will. But having said that, let's talk about the various representations that we have of the cosmic force. Reality, that is to say the cosmic force, the die Wille, is phenomenal and it consists of representations. And these representations are sometimes referred to in the English literature as ideas. Consider the etymology of Vorstellung. What does the word Vorstellung mean? It means representation, right? Vorstellung. It's something that stands in front of you. And so the Wille can make itself known to you, or shall I say, make itself felt to you, and it makes itself felt to you, it presents itself, it stands in front of you as some kind of idea. And on Monday it might come to you as one idea, and on Tuesday it might be another idea. For the lady over there, it might present itself in one way, and for the man over here, it might present itself in a different way. But the point is that Devila, the cosmic reality, has objectified itself not only in inert physical things, like this desk. You know what I mean by inert physical things? Something is inert, it just sits there. It's just for Handensein. Well, but also Devila has objectified itself, has represented itself as a human body. And so I experience Devila when I look at my hand and I touch my hand. I feel the one hand pressing against the other hand. And our bodies have brains and we have intellects as well. And we can understand what it means to have an idea. We can understand what it means to have a thought, what it means to have a memory, what it means to have an imagination. And these are all examples, not examples, these are all Vorstellungen of this basically unknowable thing called Devila. And therefore, the cosmic will not only exists within individual human beings, there's a little of Devila in each of us, but it's also indirectly, this is Devila, is indirectly responsible for the very ideas and representations we have of it. Wasn't that interesting? Say yes. Thank you. Okay. Just a little bit more on Devila. The cosmic will exists in individual persons because we have access to something more than mere representations. So how do we have this access? Well, this idea of having access to the supreme reality is loaded with sexual overtones for Schopenhauer. It's not available, normally at least, not available to conscious reflection. And the needs and demands of other people and of society at large do not figure very largely in this access. So what I've just said here, does this sound familiar? Does this sound like a certain Viennese neurologist's idea of the unconscious? Access, indirect of course, access to Devila for Schopenhauer is loaded with these things, and that is exactly what Freud said. So there are a lot of similarities between these two guys. But vive la différence. There are differences. Schopenhauer's account is a philosophical theory. And so because Schopenhauer was doing philosophy, he felt no need to verify his theory. He had found a way to describe, without contradicting himself, this notion of the world as consisting in wills, that is little wills like yours and mine, and representations. But Freud never claimed to be talking about the nature of reality itself. Freud was not talking about the Ding an sich. He was talking about just the S. And Freud thought that what he called his metapsychological, as opposed to philosophical, model of the mind was indeed verifiable. There's no verification of Schopenhauer's notion. There's no verification. Nobody's ever seen a Ding an sich. Nobody's ever smelled one. Nobody's ever fallen in love with one. There's no way that you can call Schopenhauer wrong, even though you might feel that his interpretation is a little bit, shall we say, over the top. Übertrieben? Yeah. But whatever you want to say against Schopenhauer or in favor of Schopenhauer, in this respect about verifiability and scientific status, does not apply to Freud. He thought that his model of the mind could be verified by clinical data. And that's why he kept all of these elaborate notebooks, all of these elaborate statements, records of what his clients had said. And he thought that he could detect patterns. And he thought of himself as a very empirical guy, not as a philosopher. And that's why we philosophers have trouble putting him into our club. Although the poor fellow, the psychologists don't want him either. So we each kind of say, well, you know, he can be kind of like a guest philosopher, a guest psychologist. Okay, now we're going to this Freud's notion. In this case, we have this idea. His early model of the mind was this. Basically, we didn't have es, ich, and über ich, but rather we had this idea of the unconscious and the conscious, with this other area in the middle, the preconscious. And this cartoon shows this idea of Freud as having an iceberg model of the mind. Now, when I originally set these slides up, I used as the background color this shading that you see. But my assistant told me I couldn't use it because, he said, it's hard to read. And like most assistants, he was actually very, very well in tune with the viewing audience. But I, like most professors, I did not take his advice completely. Because I had chosen this slide format to indicate that there's a kind of a shading area between these three levels of consciousness. By the way, I haven't explained what the preconscious is. Do you know what that is? Yeah. Well, give me a little break. Give the students a break from my English. Tell us what that for consciousness is. Oh no, you don't. Okay.
40 years ago.
All right. Well, it's basically this. Right now, you're conscious of the fact that you're hearing my voice. Painfully conscious, perhaps, but you're definitely conscious of my voice. You are not conscious of the fact that when you were 3 years old, you were exposed to some horrible experience. You were raped. You were beaten up, and everything. You've suppressed all that. You don't remember any of that. That is way down here in your unconscious. But way up here in the conscious is the sound of my voice. But does anybody know the German word for rabbit? How'd you know that? Where was that knowledge? Yeah, but you were able just to pick it up right like that. So it was not in your consciousness, but it was right over there. You knew exactly where to reach to get it. And how many of you came here on the auto bus today, and how many of you came by car? How many of you came by bus? How'd you know that? So this is information that is more or less ready at hand. Sometimes you say, oh, wait. Oh, no, I forgot. But in general, we have a set of ideas and memories and so on, and facts that are more or less readily available, even though we're not thinking about them at this exact moment. And that's the preconscious part of the mind. Well, later Freud moved into this other model where you had down at the bottom you had the unconscious, yes, but in the middle you had the ego, and at the top you had the superego, the uber-ich. We'll come back to that. But anyway, back to our regular coloration. We have the ego tames the id. And how does the ego tame the id? Well, it introduces the reality principle, and it shows the s that if it really wants to get what it desires, it has to make accommodations. Since you cannot have your cake and eat it too, then if you want some of this cake for tomorrow, you can only eat part of it today. Oh, okay. And then this gradual taking over of control is the Freudian attempt of ego taming the id, the pleasure principle now gives way to the reality principle. So the desires for pleasure must be satisfied, that's the pleasure principle. Yes, okay, and we're not arguing against this idea that if you have a desire it should be satisfied. We're only arguing about the schedule under which the satisfaction should proceed. And so our desires have to be managed so they do not contradict each other.
Can you take also choke?
Well, German jokes, I don't know.
This proves that, you know, half the cake and eat it, keep the cake and eat it too. My little daughter gave me that joke as a disproof. She said, the pizza baker said, do you want the pizza cut in 4 slices or 8 slices? Oh, make it 4 slices, I'm not that hungry.
Goodbye, Freud. Goodbye, Lenin. Goodbye, Freud. Goodbye, all of these. Well, what can I say? Okay. This business about the basic drives and the primary processes. The primary processes would be a little bit like what your daughter was talking about, and the secondary processes are all of the clever rational strategies. But the primary processes are the ones that I'll talk about very, very briefly. Remember now, please, that this is on the web, and don't get angry at me because I'm going too fast. I'm really, at this point, because I'm looking at the clock, I'm more anxious to show you what is available on the web than explaining it right now. If you choose not to go on the web, I can promise you that you will survive. This is not a necessary condition for getting a psychology degree or getting a good romantic relationship or even a little bit of money. But it is kind of interesting, at least. So that's the primary process. Now, how do our desires impact on each other by themselves? Well, we've got things like metaphor. We have this idea of love. We have the idea of a garden. You like your love. You like your garden. And you come up with the images and you talk about your love as a red, red rose. This is one of the ways, non-rational ways, in which we hook up desires and other kinds of feelings to each other. Another way of hooking up some of our feelings and impressions and worries and emotions and desires without going through a whole lot of intellectual thinking is just what is called metonymy, in which in English we speak of the crown referring to the king. I'm a servant of the crown. Is that auf Deutsch auch? Yeah, okay. The secondary processes in which the ego uses familiar cognitive procedures. And then there has to be some sort of a teamwork between the ego and the id, between the ich and the s. Or as Schopenhauer put it, rationality is able to direct our actions only because rationality is an objectification of will, objectivisierung der Wille. In other words, the cosmic villa has taken your little rational power and your little rational power, and it kind of stands behind them as the force. And so when you get a good idea, and you take your good idea and use it to control your lower desires, that good idea is powerful. That good idea goes in and tells the desires how to behave, precisely because that good idea is itself a representation of this cosmic reality, this cosmic je ne sais quoi. Now, of course, your desires are also representative Vorstellungen of the je ne sais quoi, the I know not what. But basically, the villa, the cosmic force, with all of its energy, is working on itself, and its various components are in teamwork in much the same way that Freud thought that the ego and the id were interacting. Later in his career, Freud came up with a third category of the uber-ego. And notice that these three components, id, I mean, s, ich, and uber-ich, are not three things, but they are three processes or functions, or, and if you want to call them components, you can. But remember that you're one person with three functions. And so here we have the Socrates saying, know thyself, and the patient, who is Sigmund Freud himself, is saying, know thyself. He said, well, is that it, or is that ego, or is that superego? Well, it's all three. Method of inquiry, never mind Schopenhauer. I'm just going to sail through this. We have the psychoanalytical method, we have repressions, clinical interview, and so on. We have this idea of psychoanalysis. We're all guilty. We all feel guilt. Even those of us who are normal. Will those of us who are normal please raise their hand? Yeah, okay, well, we're realistic at least. But anyway, Freud felt that normal people should also get therapy, especially if these normal people are going to be therapists. Psychoanalysis is good for you even if you're not in some sort of deep neurotic or psychotic condition. So, with just a few more quick remarks here. Freud's famous book, Civilization and Its Discontent, is only one part of what he had to say about the basic goal of psychoanalysis. We have here, in this case, screening your memories, where the woman is looking at the beautiful picture of her memory, but what really happened as a kid is her father or mother or somebody was beating her up. We have this metaphor of sublimation, where what you really want to do is go out and have some, you know, really raunchy sex, but you know that that's not appropriate, and so you instead become an artist or a philosopher or a scientist or a psychologist. Clinical method case studies. Well, Freud considered psychoanalysis as an art. Not, well, it had scientific points, but it was basically artistic. And there's more to be said on this. The little notes that accompany it, I like to think, are useful. But given the time, it's not time appropriate to go into it now. We have Schopenhauer's conception of morality. I think I'll let that speak for itself, too. I'd like to just roll through the last couple of slides, ego and superego, pointing out, first of all, Freud described the uber-ego as the internalized voice of your parent. The Marxist philosopher and historian Michel Foucault, he had the same idea. He knew it was Freud. He said that the surveillance and punishment method was the method of control writ large. The Marxist philosopher Herbert Marcuse held that a truly human society would have room for many types of personality because we had many stages of sexuality that we go through. And because we all went through the anal stage, we all went through the oral stage, we all went through the phallic stage and then the genital stage, there ought to be room in our civilization for expressing all of these different modalities. But that presents a problem, because if you want to have some kind of sexual experience in the workplace, in the factory and so on, you know, it's not going to work. You know, you can't say, well, we'll have a few minutes now where everybody can go out in the back room and, you know, have raunchy sex. No, that civilization insists that we contain our libidinal desires. Why? Because the libidinal desires are bad? Well, that's what civilization tries to tell us. But the real reason, this is Marcuse talking, the real reason that civilization tells us to take control of our sexual and other bodily impulses is they interfere with the economic production process. Well, isn't that a bummer? Now, very briefly, the relationship that these guys had to contemporary psychology. Schopenhauer's influence is entirely channeled through Freud. I've already indicated that it's a little problem about whether Freud himself is a psychologist. But within the subdomain of clinical psychology, there is more tolerance for Freud, and although only a few clinicians practice his therapy long term, nonetheless, they use some of his ideas. Conclusion. Freud was a hybrid. He was both a philosopher and a psychologist, even though neither group would want to spell that out with a capital P at the beginning. One thing is undeniable. Freud and his theory was definitely one of the roots of contemporary psychology. And now, for our finale as we march out to the bus, if you are interested in having a very nice little... I thought this was going to... maybe we're not... It's not a bad dramatization. Well, I guess... Oh, there it goes. Okay. I hope we get audio. Oh, we probably won't. You know what? Anyway, you can see... And this is serious. It's kind of lighthearted, but it's serious.
Der Tod.
Can you hear?
Ist der eigentliche inspirierende Genius oder der Mystagie der Philosophie? Jeder Atem. Wir den beständig eindringenden Tod, in der negativen Weise, in jeder Sekunde kämpfen. Zuletzt muss er siegen, denn wir sind ihm schon durch die Geburt anheimgefallen. Und er spielt nur eine Weile mit seiner Beute, bevor er sie verschlingt. Das philosophische Erstaunen ist immer ein ungeheuerlicher Schutz. Die Philosophie lebt, die Oberführung zu der Krankheit.
I don't think I could put it better myself. Thank you very much.